Accession number 1766. Thomas Lawton, reel 20.
Mr. Lawton, reel 20. Where did you get this food from?
Oh, this is a good story. I'll tell it towards the end, right? Not far now. As I've said, all is quiet as the men bite into their meat pies and wipe the gravy off their chins with the backs of their hands. I raised my glass, and my cup rather, and called for a toast to the folk at home. The others raised their chins, cups in silence. Eyes looked to eyes which see it all. Outside, brilliant stars hang low in a velvet sky, outshining the spaced lights which glitter on the frosted barbed wire of the perimeter fence. Posterns in their raised watch boxes stamp their straw-encased feet to keep the blood flowing, and the frozen ground glistens with myriads of topaz lights, and how easy it is to imagine that all is peaceful and well, while knowing that it is not so. Inside Hut 93, men have snuggled into their bunks, hoping to get some sleep through the clinging cold, thinking about home and loved ones, longing for the day when they will be free men again, if ever. Maybe some of them are smiling, in the knowledge that to the imagination, nothing is impossible. Not even a good nosh-up. When the hut lights are switched off from the main gate, as the men curl up under whatever cover they have, hoping to sleep, perchance to dream, they call out, "Good night all," and roll on next Friday, knowing it will be 1 week more, but also 1 week less, and the imagination will rise again. See, why they say that one of God's gifts to man is intuition. I reckon a God-given gift is imagination, if you use it in a positive manner. And one night while we were sitting in the hut and everybody's imagining what's happening at home and they're imagining what's happening here and there and what was going to happen to us, I said, why not use it positively? I could just imagine that I would eat a nice meat steaky pie, and the gravy's running off my chin, and now having a good swill of beer after it, see? And that started the whole thing going. With the result, every Friday night, we went into the region of imagination. George Jones didn't have a bicycle. There was no bicycles in the camp. And Rudge Whitworth, if there had been, the Australians would have pinched it, because they were good at that. There was no smokes, we had none. But the imagination built it up. And that's why they said, good night all, sleep well, yes, and roll on next Friday night when we'll have another good nosh-up in the imagination.
Was there problems between yourselves and the other Commonwealth and colonial people?
No, sometimes a little bit of rivalry. As for instance, the New Zealanders put a notice on the board to say they had always understood that the bagpipe was a musical instrument. But it can't be, because the Germans do not allow musical instruments to be played out there on the parade ground. You play them inside. And yet, the Scotsmen are allowed to play the bagpipe outside. Oh, that goes right, see? It was not a musical instrument. It was a means of saving the breath when in a charge in savage days. Things like that. Everybody looked forward to the Geordie night because they knew everything would go wrong, which it generally did. Not intentionally, but it went wrong, Geordie like. And on one occasion, everybody set fire to everybody because they were going to have a birthday party for Jed's baby. They were all dressed like Yankee farmers, beards on, and handkerchiefs around their neck, and a cigarette, which were going to light. And the point is, when they were handing the cigarette round, or it wasn't a light, it was like a torch that they had, handed round, there was one man had a mouth full of paraffin. And he was supposed to spit that paraffin in such a way that it flew across the bridge, across the stage. But on this night, it didn't go across the stage. It went round the whole, and so everybody was on fire. Their beards were on fire, their neckerchiefs were on fire, and everybody clapped and everybody howled, and the curtains went through, and the show stopped. But everybody clamoured for more. So Gilda Jordy and Joe, they came back on to continue with the motion, with all kinds of paint on their face, their beards were gone, and little bits of things like that. Just a mistake somewhere, and it caused an uproar. And if it happened to anybody, it was sure to happen to the Geordies.
So you got a lot of this material through the Red Cross, did you? Musical instruments and so forth?
Oh, yes.
What else were the Red Cross sending to you outside of food and this kind
clothing,
of thing?
Clothing. Boots. Clothing.
Were they sending... Were some men able to go on educational courses?
I was thinking, though... In a camp like 383, there was all kinds of educational courses. And I'll tell you what else there was, dancing classes. The Germans couldn't believe it. About a great big building, entertainment building, and right round the wall there was every coat of arms you could think of. And the photograph of the Queen. And we were allowed to have that up there. We could put the king up now. And the Germans seemed to respect that. And all those coats of arms right round, everybody, marvellous painters, marvellous artists. There was, I think it would be all kind of university person in that camp. But dancing, well, you can only dance with another man. But before you could dance, you had to know how to pose. So a whole class of men. And then the instructor said, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And the Germans could not believe it. Then the men started dancing with each other. And men in that camp got dancing master certificates. They became dancing instructors. Other things, I mean, men would go on courses for languages and all kinds of things. I would think they could nearly accommodate anyone who wanted to be... to learn, but the men were so hungry and so worried, it took a strong man to want to improve himself.
How did your health hold up?
Mine held up very well. Some fellas, not too good. But I was always kind of blessed with that kind of, wherever I was working, I could always do it. And I never had any trouble other than, like everybody else, dysentery and that kind of thing. But got weak, yes. I once got an extra parcel through a fake. Rations got to the point where there was no rations, and the only parcels were invalid parcels. And there was some medical men in that camp, which you very seldom saw, and they took control. And if a man was weird, and if he lost so many... such a nose weight, he was entitled to a parcel. And when I went in to be weighed, I said, well, do I take my coat off? No, keep it on. Great coat. Keep it on. It's cold. Right. So I was weighed. And then a month's time, you go back to weighed again. Well, I said, I'll keep my coat on. And I put an open shelf underneath it. That was when I was first weighed. I was weighed with an oven shelf under my greatcoat, and the next time I went, I didn't have the oven shelf, and I'd lost so much weight, I got an invalid parcel, which consisted of bits of chocolate and milk and that, see, which you had to share out. But on one occasion in Stalag 383, a corporal came to the hut and he says, Sergeant Major Lawton. I said, yes. He says, there is a parcel for you. What? A parcel. We haven't seen anything for weeks and weeks and weeks. This could be as far back as the September of 1943. Things were getting bad. A parcel, yes. A Ford parcel, yes. I had to go and collect it up at the patrolman's room. So when I went out, the lads left it, got a dish, filled it with water, got some paper, stuffed in the stove, get the water hot, because you see, everything in my food parcel is going into that dish. And everybody mixed in with it, see? So I went to the patrolman's room, and oh, he says, officer, parcel for you. And he held up a thing no bigger than a small book. And I said, is that a foot parcel? Go with the foot parcel. It's for you. It's a foot parcel. A spiritual foot parcel. I said, oh, what? A spiritual foot parcel. It came from the women of Durham. And there was like a little prayer book in it. There was prayer sheets and bits of things like that, see? And when I went back in the room, I said, what's that? A spiritual food parcel. Aye, why? What's the paper like? Why, paper like paper, paper, that's nice paper. I'm doing the roll cigarettes in if I had any baggy. Oh, used for toilet, because you never had any toilets, would you? And when I came back, I wrote to Durham to the women. And I thanked them for the parcel. But I also said, you see, circumstances alter cases. As broken noses alter faces, circumstances alter cases. And where one, under some circumstances, I would have really been pleased to receive that, I felt insulted. Obviously, they didn't do any different. And I know I got a letter back from them, but I had to tell them all. To let them know I got the parcel, but it was at the wrong time.
Were the Red Cross parcels always the same items in it?
No.
They varied?
An English Red Cross parcel, you got the Canadian and the English. An English Red Cross parcel, yes, and the Canadian. And, well, a lot of people prefer the Canadian because it had a nice tin of milk in it, had nice butter and all that kind of thing. The English parcel had a bigger variety, a little bit more variety than the Canadian. But the Canadian was a good one, and so was the British. And when you're hungry, it's a good thing.
What might you have in each of those two?
Well, there was always butter. There was always some sugar. There was always a tin of milk. A tin of sardines without doubt. Sometimes a tin of jam. Quite a mixture. I think they said about 10 pounds of food, that's in weight. And then the Canadian parcel, it was more like a dairy parcel. You got powdered milk, Klim milk, which was milk spelled backwards, see? And those tins were a nice big tin. They made smoky juice from them.
How long were you in this camp?
Eh?
How long were you in 383?
Until they moved us out and were on the march to Munich. So we went there 1943. I was thinking the beginning of 1943. So we'd be there a year. About September of 44 was when things got rough. I would say a year and a half.
And you would hear of D-Day when you were there.
Eh?
You would hear of D-Day when you were there.
No.
You didn't?
No. We were in the camp. You see?
Where were you on D-Day?
Somewhere on the plains near the foothills of Bavaria, of the Alps, Bavarian Alps, when General Blood and Guts Patton's men caught up with her. That's a story, by the way.
Well, we'll come to that.
We'll come to that later, see? So we've dealt with the handcuffing, and we've talked about the imagination, and that finishes that.
So what happened to you next then, when you
well,
moved from this camp?
We must now come on to the theatricals. Because you cannot hold a stage show without you've got the proper clothes, and I've got dozens of photographs. People look and say, where was that taken? I said, black women in there, no? Well, that man's got that black woman bent over. That's a little Scottish footballer, bow-legged, actually. Dressed as a woman. So we had our own tailors. And the tailor shop and the theatricals and the stage shows were used for escape routes. Now, everybody wanted to get out of the camp, if it was just to say they'd been out, which was common sense if you had somewhere to go. But individuals had an awful job. Every picture I've ever seen of escapees, they've been haunted here and there, they've been hunted and that. I got out. I went on an escape route to Budapest, and I got to Budapest, two of us, through the escape organisation in Stalag 383.
Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes. I've got all this, don't you, lad?
How was it organised? What kind of an escape was it?
Yeah, well, solitary confinement. Concert parties were used as an aid for escape, insomuch that the camp tailors made all manner of wearing apparel for the different sketches and scenes. Intended escapees were often selected from among the artists taking part in a play or sketch, which involved characters and circumstances which could be met with by an escapee outside. Necessary Ausweises, travel cards, identity cards, money, timetable, train timetables, etc., instructions where to change train, were all to hand, brought in by Germans who were being bribed. Bargaining with chocolate, tea, coffee, and other things which Germans had never even enjoyed in their lives, plus the fact that among 12,000 to 15,000 men, British and colonial, there were no shortage of con men and sleight-of-hand men, also the civilians who came into the lager, such as joiners, etc., etc., were trusted men. In Poland, there would have been Poles who would have been scared to do anything. But in Bavaria, they were trusted Bavarians. There were times when they were among the prisoners of war for hours, who would steal the sugar out of their cups if they had any. And they had never had chocolates or cigarettes, anything such as that. So once they accepted a gift, they were collared. They couldn't get over it. They'd accepted a gift. And they say, well, we'll tell them. Right? And they were frightened of each other. I've heard Germans say that we were better comrades to them than their own comrades were, because they could talk to us. Consequently, money, maps, all necessary papers were part of the trade. We also knew that in different parts of Germany, people pronounced words differently. We also knew that there was a great deal of this fry vinegar, God, which were all nations speaking all different languages. So we knew then that once you got out, you had a chance to pass off as anything else other than a German. You could pass off a German if you tried. We were told when to speak Plattdeutsch and when to speak Hoyerdeutsch, if you spoke German at all. So that according to circumstances, even if we were vulnerable and had to be very careful, not very good at German, there were loopholes. Jack Tingle was a regular artiste. He was a good footballer and a good sergeant in general, but he was also a regular artiste in all the plays. He was slightly bow-legged, but he was also a sergeant of the Dublin Infantry, He had been in my company when we were at Dunkirk to serve with me, and we became prisoners of war together almost. We were in several lagers together. Sergeant Joe Roberts from London, Rifle Brigade, he was responsible for all kinds of things. Jack took the part of Charlie's aunt in the sketch of that name, which was a huge success in Stalag 383. It ran for a whole month while everyone in the lager enjoyed it. Jack was such a good Charlie's aunt, he was earmarked as an escapee in the shape of Charlie's aunt, an old spinster. All he needed was a Charlie to travel with him. And in so much that Jack and I were always together, I was asked if I would be the Charlie. So I said yes. I would travel as Charlie's aunt's nephew, a little younger than Auntie, and exempt from military service because of poor eyesight. I would wear dark glasses, and I was a farmer. Auntie would be hard of hearing, though travelling openly by railway, and on the railway we would be going to somewhere which we didn't know about and wouldn't know about until at least only 2 days before we went.
This was all part of the planning.
Oh yes, it's all part of the plan. This was the difference between getting off on your own. You're picked and you were not allowed to do anything on your own. Everything was done for you. All you had to do was take the part. I was to be a 34-year-old farmer. Jack was my 50-year-old aunt. But we were not told where we were going until 2 days prior to the move. We were not told why we were going, but we were given a route to study. Times, as near as possible, of trains, stations, where we would change train, and even the platform numbers where necessary. All day. We practiced certain phrases in German with a German-speaking Yorkshireman who had lived in Germany for several years before the war. We had German newspapers and magazines, old, but nevertheless, they had articles in them. And we rehearsed our parts together as we walked and talked together as normal, but never did we give anyone the slightest hint in any way that we were going out. We had been in Stalag 383 only 6 months at that time, and like most men, we were strangers outside our own barracks or blocks. Germans had stooges planted amongst us, and like the Germans, we did not trust each other, who did not trust each other, neither did we. Eventually, we were told to be ready to move in 3 weeks' time, nothing definite, because of possible changing circumstances. We met the organization under cover of concert rehearsals for information. We did not even know how we would leave the lager. Everything would be prepared and all arrangements made by the escape committee. Timetables and routes we had to study all pointed in the direction of Budapest. And in so much that I was a farmer, and in Budapest there was a worldwide acknowledged agricultural centre or university that could be our destination. At last we learned the day and the date, and it was the 15th of July, St. Swithin's Day, my 37th birthday.
Was that 1944?
That was 1943. We'd only been in the camp about six months then, 43. I was Kurt Reuben, and Jack was Fraulein Niebels, a spinster. We left from Hohenfels, Bavaria, travelling to Budapest to stay with her and Frau Simlings, who were relatives of Jack's of, you know. While I would attend the agricultural university for approximately 6 months. Periodically, when international Red Cross parcels arrived at Hohenfels station, four or five work parties were detailed to go to the station to offload the parcels from the train onto camp vehicles. Parties had to go with them. Railway trucks transferred from the railway trucks to the lorries to take them to the lager. Notification had been received that parties would be required under armed guard for the 15th of July 1943. How the numbers of men in the parties would be juggled was not of our business. All we had to do was to be dressed for travelling under our prisoner of war clothes. And then, following instructions at the station, get lost among the German troops and civilians who would be thronging the station. It was emphasised that we must not imagine that everyone was watching us. Even the men of the parties would not miss us until they arrived back in camp, if then. The German troops and civilians had more to think about than to suspect us. We must remember who we were, what we were, to where we were going, and with whom we were going to stay, her and Frau Simlings, who lived in an upstairs apartment at number 106B, Reinhardtplatz, Budapest, District 2. They were retired business people who were born in Budapest and relatives with whom we would stay. Jack joined one party on the wagons. I joined another at the station. We were selected to work with a special party which boarded the truck containing the parcels, which were handed out to be loaded and onto the lager lorries. That party was also a special. They carried our suitcases, money, documents, a briefcase for me, a shopping bag for Auntie containing a flask of coffee and a few sandwiches and a couple of magazines. The men of the special party knew what was what, and at a pre-arranged time, they caused some confusion, caused by a miscount, which was easy doing, while we were slipped out among the travellers in our semi-clothes and just became one or two of them. One important item was to go keep our prisoner of war discs, which would make all the difference if we were arrested. As far as I can remember, we would travel from Hohenfels to Stuttgart, then to Munich, change for Linz to Vienna, and then on to Budapest, a distance of approximately 700 miles. Isn't it possible? Time depended upon conditions, troop movements, Allied bombing, etc. It all sounded so easy, but it was difficult to just become one of the crowd. However, with Auntie being a little deaf and me being a short-sighted, we tried to see and hear that which would make us feel okay as country cousins in the big crowd. If it was remarkable how people tried to help us. Aye, there's two. Our first big test would be when the ticket collector came to us on the train among the other passengers. He would want to check more than tickets. But we had been instructed not to show him anything unless he asked to see it, and never to speak to anyone whom we thought could be Gestapo. After all, we were obviously innocents abroad, and he would not have time to waste on us. All went well. He did not trouble us, but there were others from whom he wanted to see everything. No one bothered us, but when we arrived in Munich, we asked, unnecessarily, if we should change there for Linz. We knew we should, but we asked. And why? Who showed us the platform? We were told, yes, by about four different passengers. We did so, and from then we began to feel more easy, and we had to be careful not to speak in English.